This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There have been reams of material written about the civil rights era and the changes it brought to America. There have been reams of material written about the transformation of the old South into the new and the politics of dealing with ending the suffocating oppression of the Jim Crow era and the implementation of integration. But most of those tomes have focused on the leaders of the movement and the politics involved in transforming the country. But Helen Kaufman has written about this period through a different lens by looking at how ordinary people dealt with extraordinary times in the best ways they knew how. She grew up in Edenton, and the book about the changes she and her family members experienced is called White Gloves and Collards. Helen Kaufman joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program. Welcome back. Welcome home.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Because you live in San Diego now,
right? I do.
Incidentally, she'll be signing her book tonight at 7 at Park Road Books. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Although this is not strictly a civil rights book, in fact, it is a memoir, it's been a long time since the civil rights era and a long time since much of what you write about in the book took place, because much of this concentrates on your life as a young girl, literally young, 5, 6, 7 years old, and then up through high school. Why did you decide now was the time to write this book about that period?
A couple of reasons. One reason, I wanted to put something in writing for my children about my childhood. They've always been curious about what it was like to grow up in the South. They grew up in Massachusetts and in California. They visit the South. They go to Edenton to visit family. But as they got older, they became very curious about the social history of the South, in particular the civil rights era. And they wanted to know what it was like. And they also wanted to know about grandparents that they never had a chance to know because they were gone by the time my children were born.
What is it about the South that fascinates people, do you think? I mean, and you're pretty close to this. I mean, people in other parts of the country read Southern authors and read about the South, and sometimes Southerners are made into caricatures because for some reason we appear to be different than the rest of the country. I don't know quite why. But what if, since you're so close to two people, your children, who are not Southerners, were not raised here, what so fascinates them about it?
Well, I think when you read about the South, I think there's a real dichotomy. I mean, there's the Southern charm, the history, the romanticized part of the South, but then there's that horrible racial history. And I think sometimes it's hard to get a handle on what the South really is because you have these extreme visions of what the South should be. My kids' own experience was around family who were wonderful, nothing but caring and warm people who love my children, and my children always loved to visit. Mm-hmm. But as they became more socially aware, they would notice the epithets that were sometimes used by relatives, and they kind of wondered how could really good, kind people have attitudes that to them seem pretty much in the dark ages.
But now you moved after college to New England and spent a lot of time in Boston, correct?
That's correct.
And your kids grew up in Boston and
yes.
Then moved with you to California. And Boston is not exactly a bastion of racial integration.
No, it is not. In fact, in 1973, when I moved there, Boston was in the middle of the busing crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think Charlotte has had its own experience.
So what's the difference between Northerners' approach to racial issues and the South's approach to racial issues?
In my opinion, I think in the South, we have there's more interaction between the races. And people know each other on a personal level. In New England, it seems that race issues are talked about, in a way that's more intellectual, not really knowing people. It's the concept, knowing that an ideal is racial equality. Mm-hmm. I think when busing happened, people were confronted with the race issue affecting them. People in South Boston, a very close-knit community, and Charlestown suddenly had to deal with people from Roxbury and parts of Dorchester, mm-hmm. African-American kids coming into their community, and they felt threatened. And they'd never really had the experience of interacting with African-Americans, I think, the way Southerners have.
Which to me makes them all the more curious, more curious than Southerners. So I'm just curious as to why the rest of the country sees us as peculiar when that seems peculiar to me.
Good question. I think it's easy to be curious when you don't have to deal with conflict and issues in your day-to-day life.
Yeah. So describe Edenton, the Edenton of your childhood prior to integration, the Jim Crow era, which you do a great job of in the book, but just give us a thumbnail.
Yeah. The Edenton of my childhood was bucolic in a lot of ways. As a child, I could go anywhere I wanted. I could hop on my bike. I could go to the movies at the Taylor Theater. I could go to the drugstore. I could go fishing in the bay right outside of my house. I had family in the country. I could go to my granddaddy's farm and play. I had relatives in town. My close-knit extended family was always there. There was always something to do. But it was also a very separate society between blacks and whites. We had black maids. And through them, I got a little glimpse into the African-American community, but not really, because there were so many little rules of behavior. And, you know, you couldn't play with black children up after a certain age. It was okay when you were little, but, you know, after you were 6 or 7 or in school, that was taboo. So there were just strange rules that you just kind of accepted until someone questioned them, and you'd think, oh, maybe this doesn't make sense.
There were a lot of things about that era that to modernize seem strange, and I guess that's one of the reasons you wrote the book, because your kids did not grow up in that era. They don't, and a lot of people today don't understand it. They just can't wrap their head around what the world was like, and it wasn't that long ago, really.
No.
But as that era recedes into history, we tend to pick out heroes and villains. Martin Luther King is a hero. George Wallace perhaps might be viewed in some circles as a villain. But back then, they were just people. And no one, I guess, a lot of people were confused about what was right and what was wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we look back, we want to look at the civil rights era in stark terms. Tolerance versus intolerance, good versus evil, the oppressor, the victim. And from my experience, it wasn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
You just had people just dealing with change the best way they knew how.
And although it was black versus white, literally, in many cases, it wasn't exactly a black-white issue. The lines between what was obviously right to us and what was obviously wrong to us were blurry. It was gray. It wasn't black and white.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it's very hard to change. And when you're brought up with a way of life and suddenly it's challenged, it's a little hard to grasp what's going on. And I think that was true with African-Americans in the community as well as whites.
Anybody who can write a memoir, I salute, because I can't remember yesterday. And you you go back to your childhood, and you talk about all these relatives who have now faded into the mists of time with great clarity. How did you take yourself back to that place and time?
First of all, I made the decision to tell my story from the perspective of a younger me experiencing events.
Mm-hmm.
Which really freed me up to get rid of all this 21st century hindsight and try to relive the experiences that I had. So I try to get into my skin as a younger kid, and I wrote about those experiences. And in some ways, it was painful, especially my mother's illness and death. That was hard to write about.
Mm-hmm.
But because I was telling the story from the perspective of a younger me, I didn't worry about, oh my gosh, is this going to offend someone? You know, is this offensive to 21st century sensibilities? I could just go into the head of a younger me and just tell my story with as much honesty as I possibly could. And once I started, once I made that decision, it became actually easy to put my memories on paper.
And as I read through this, you know, we tend to remember the civil rights era as one with a lot of milestones in it. This is when this happened, and therefore minds began to change. Perhaps it was for some people seeing on the TV news the water hoses being turned on people in Selma, Alabama, because TV news cut its teeth on the civil rights era. Maybe for others it was something else. What I got out of your book is that there weren't that many milestones of national importance that changed minds in your family or that made people's hearts soften. It just kind of happened in some cases.
It did, and I think the attitude of a lot of people was that that's Alabama, that's Mississippi. Mm. Our town's peaceful. You know, we don't have those kinds of problems, and I think the one thing that I heard a lot that was repeated often, especially when the way of life was challenged with sit-ins and demonstrations, it was, our colors are happy. You know, it's agitators coming in and stirring things up. Things are fine here.
Yeah.
And I think having that attitude made the whole process of accepting change much slower.
Yeah.
And harder.
Your grandmother said that, didn't she?
Or was it Oh, yes. Well, I heard it from lots of people.
And you point out that this was a time when some hearts and minds changed, but others clung to what you call a myth-filled past. Was the myth that the coloreds, as you refer to them in the book, because that's how they were referred to back then, was the myth that they were happy in their lives?
Oh, yes.
Even though they were deprived, even though they didn't have a full slate of rights, they were content.
That was the attitude.
And why did we believe that, do you think?
I think
because we chose to?
I think probably because it was a choice, but if your beliefs aren't challenged, you hang on to them. And I think it took a movement, the civil rights movement, and actions of the African-American community to make people suddenly think twice about what they'd always thought.
Some minds were never changed and still haven't changed.
Absolutely.
Other minds were changed relatively quickly and even before the majority of the country began to see the wrongs that had been perpetrated for hundreds of years. And you were among those people. Why do you think you were questioning the status quo at a pretty young age?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. I think having situations where things just don't make sense. In my book, I had a chapter about the maid bringing her daughter to work one day.
Right.
And I had such a good time playing with her. I was a little skeptical at first that she was there because she was black.
Yeah, she came and sat herself down on the couch while you and I think your brother were watching television.
Yeah, yeah.
And that had never happened before.
Yeah. And then as I got to know her and as we talked, I realized we had a lot in common, and I wanted to have another play date.
Yeah.
And then it was explained to me, this was an unusual circumstance. You know, she had to come to work with her mother because the mother couldn't come to work unless she brought her daughter that particular day. And things like that just didn't make sense. And that's when you'd start questioning things. I also had in my book a description of the first sit-ins at the pharmacy's soda fountain. And I don't even think I ever thought that black people couldn't sit down at the soda fountain counter.
Mm-hmm.
And when it happened, I thought, oh, this is terrible, because all the adults were saying, oh, my goodness, this is the end of the world. We're having sit-ins here in Edenton. And in that case, I think it was my older brother, Norfleet, who questioned me and asked me, you know, what's wrong with having a black person sit next to you at the soda fountain? And I was hard-pressed to come up with an answer.
Mm. Helen Kaufman's our guest. Her memoir is called White Gloves and Collards. The title, I think, is probably obvious as to what the meaning of it is, but we'll ask about that when we come back in a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Diamond Springs, offering bottled water, coffee, and filtration services to the home or office. More information about Diamond Springs at 1-800-715-2286. Planned Parenthood has been an advocate for women's reproductive health for nearly 100 years, but for many of those years, they have been surrounded by controversy due to abortions. But they do more than that. In fact, they are the nation's largest provider of sex education and are involved in men's sexual health as well. North Carolina has become a top priority for Planned Parenthood, and we'll find out why when we hear tomorrow from the president of the national organization. That begins tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on Bo Bergdahl's release, new questions about the terms of the Taliban prisoner swap and the implications for national security, congressional oversight, and efforts to close Guantanamo.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Helen Pruden Kaufman. I mentioned the last name Pruden because evidently in Edenton that is a fairly well-known name. It goes back hundreds of years. She's written a book called White Gloves and Collards. It's a memoir which covers her childhood but mostly covers also the civil rights era and the changing minds and hearts of many people and the lack of changing minds and hearts of others. Why the name White Gloves and Collards? Why the title? I think I know, but tell us.
Initially, it was to describe my mother.
Okay.
My mother grew up in the country. She was a country girl, and she married into Edenton's White Gloves Society. So I thought White Gloves and Collards would be the perfect title. But then as I got into writing the memoir, I realized how much race was part of my upbringing. And the title took on a broader meaning because traditionally collards have been a staple food of African Americans as well as rural whites.
And you write in the book of a little episode where you, I guess there was you were visiting a relative and there was a stand of pine trees between their house and sharecroppers. And you wandered over to the other yard by yourself one day and wandered into this old woman's house, and she was sitting by a wood fire cooking a pot of collards, and she offered you some, and you ate it.
Yeah, actually, it was my mother.
Oh, your mother, I'm sorry.
Yes, okay. She told me that story.
Okay, all right.
And she told me that story as a way to explain why the daughter of the maid couldn't come back for another play date.
I see.
And she had sat down at the table with these people, and when my grandfather heard about it, he was furious, and he actually gave her a beating because white girls were not supposed to enter, I'll say a colored person because that's probably the word he used, their house and sit down at their table. That was simply not done.
Wow. One of the many rules, which I want to talk about as we go through this program, you lost both of your parents at a very early age. Your father died at 6. Your mother died, 16, 17 years
16.
Old?
16.
And she was fairly ill, and you were preoccupied with being a cheerleader at the time in high school, which is what girls of that age in that time period did. So given the fact that they both passed on fairly early in your life, where did your values come from, do you think?
I would say my mother and my brother. I was 16 when my mother died, so I did have 16 years with her.
Right.
And she had an interest in things beyond just Edenton. She read the Sunday New York Times religiously. Mm-hmm. I remember going to the drugstore before church because there'd be a stack of New York Times that came in on the Trailways bus early in the morning, and there were a few people who subscribed. She was one of them. And we'd pick up this huge newspaper, and after we'd go to church and then go visit family out on the farm, the project was to get through the New York Times, and she would read everything.
Wow.
And my brother Norfleet, who was a smarty pants, he was older than me, he would read articles too, and they would talk about them. And, of course, I was interested only in paper dolls and little Lulu and that sort of thing when I was younger.
Right.
I would listen, and I think that affected me quite a bit. Mm. And they both had this sense of fairness, and I just think it affected me.
You write about all of your relatives on both sides of the family, your mother's side, your father's side, and brothers and sisters of your parents and things like that, and grandmothers. And their take on relationships between races was slightly different from that of your mother. Your mother's kind of on the fence. Your mother's a transitional figure, at least the way she's written in this book. Why do you suppose she wasn't precisely like the others?
For one reason, I think it was because she was of two different worlds. She was a country girl. She grew up fairly poor, and her family never had black help as my father's side of the family did, always did. There were farm workers, there were people who helped out, but there was never that situation of this interaction on a daily basis as there was with my father's side of the family, because they always had maids or yardsmen or whatever, and she was kind of in the middle there. So yeah. I think that might have freed her up to be a little more open-minded.
It's really interesting to read this and listen to people's attitudes about, because there's a dichotomy going on in many of these people. For instance, you spent a lot of time at a young age at your grandmother Meg's house, and as sweet as she was, you remember her complaining about the Earl Warren Supreme Court. And I remember driving through the South on the way to Florida in the 1960s and seeing signs everywhere that said impeach Earl Warren once you got past Virginia. But anyway, she hated Earl Warren's Supreme Court, but she loved Democratic presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson. She said that the Warren Court, he has no business telling us how to treat our coloreds. What was it about Adlai Stevenson that she liked?
Because she was a Democrat through and through. She was what I guess is called a yellow dog Democrat. And it didn't matter who you were. If you were a Democrat, she was going to support you.
And she made that comment about that court has no business telling us how to treat our coloreds in front of her maid, Lucy. That struck me as being right out of that movie in the book, The Help. Did you see that movie?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
How can people be smart and so insensitive, do you think?
I think in a lot of ways The Help was considered invisible in certain situations. They were there to serve, to help, to clear the table, to serve the food. And I think there was just people didn't think of them as being there.
You write, at the age of 7, you were just beginning to understand the intricacies of black-white relations, with so many innuendos, contradictions, and illogical rules to grasp. What were some of the rules that you remember?
Well, one was the not being able to play with black children, not being able to play inside a home. You could play on neutral turf, but you couldn't bring a black child home to play with you. That was the main one. Other things, I think later on when I was probably 17 or so, I ran into a former maid on the street and hugged her. And my aunt told me, you're too old for that. You know, people will think you are, and she used a term that I won't repeat.
And somebody corrected you because you referred to an older black gentleman by Mr. So-and-so. And I think one of your relatives corrected you and said, no, his name is, I don't know his first name, but for the sake of our conversation, his name's Henry.
Right.
You don't call him by Mr. So-and-so.
Yeah, this was the janitor at our church, and the minister's family referred to him as Mr. Austin, which I did, and I was talking to my great aunt Mag, and I said, Mr. Austin did something, and she said, no, you do not call a colored by their last name. His name is Vance.
And as I say, this was not that long ago. So when you look back on just this short amount of time, is it a lot of progress that we have made, or is it just not a lot? We still have, I know we have a ways to go, but is it a lot of progress that we have made?
It's a lot of progress, I think, if you look in legal terms at civil rights issues, but as far as attitudes go, yeah, we have a long way to go.
I got the impression in reading that your mother didn't buy into all this nonsense, that she saw the other side of the equation, but she was schooling you on how to operate in that world and what you could and couldn't do, or should and shouldn't do. Is that because she was just trying to get along in this world and didn't want to rock the boat? How do you explain that? Her understanding that this was not really right, but we have to survive. We have to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was she wanted my brother and me to grow up successfully and be able to cope with the society that we were born in, but also to have an open mind and look at things from different angles.
You were in the fourth grade when that sit-in that you referred to a few minutes ago took place for the first time in Edenton, and I would think that a fourth grader didn't really wouldn't really understand what was going on. Why would they? So when you look back on that period and you try to write about it in this book, how did you do that?
I remember the time because there was so much anxiety among the adults that this would happen in Edenton. You know, it had happened probably a few months before in Greensboro, and we all know about the sit-in at the Woolworths counter in Greensboro. But to happen in Edenton, people were horrified, and they were so afraid of integration. And I think as a child, I knew there's something looming in the distance, and it's not a good thing because of the way adults talked about it.
When you read some of these comments, and I guess you're paraphrasing, but the comments are in quotes, for instance, Meg saying about that sit-in, "Our coloreds are happy. It's all those outsiders coming in and stirring things up. Those young coloreds marched right in and took a seat on the lunch counter stools just like they owned the place. Can you imagine such a thing?" That sounds incredibly ignorant to 21st century ears.
Yes, it does.
Were they ignorant or were they racists?
Somewhere in between, I'd say.
Would they have considered themselves racist? Should we consider?
No, because I think we are good to our coloreds, they would probably say in the same breath that our coloreds are happy. And I think probably for a lot of people it was inconceivable that there would be protest.
So you wrote this book in part for your kids to understand where you came from and what the South was like and where it has come in all these years. When they read things like that, that came out of the words of people that they are related to, came out of the mouths of people that they are related to, what was their reaction?
I think it provided some clarity because as they became older, they did visit relatives and they would hear some of these things and question them. And I think it provided a little context. They understood why their aunt might use a certain term and why she might have certain attitudes. I think it helped them understand a little bit better what I grew up among.
Many of these people that you write about passed on probably in the 60s or 70s. They're not here, but maybe some of them survive. Have those who have survived, have their attitudes changed?
I guess one of the fortunate things or unfortunate things about writing this memoir is that most of my characters are dead, so I don't have to worry about them being offended.
I was going to ask how people in the family are taking the book.
Right, and the younger generation obviously changed. My cousins, I think we, like most people in the South, we have evolved, and I think I'd like to say we're much more enlightened now.
Well, Meg, who's incorrectly called her your grandmother, she was your great aunt.
Great aunt.
Despite what she says regularly in the book about the coloreds that we would find offensive today, she regularly gave to the United Negro College Fund.
Yep.
How do you explain that?
Because she liked the people. She had relationships with the people who worked for her. She did not hate black people. She felt that they should be educated, but in their own schools. That was her belief.
And yet, she says that it was the right thing to do when President Kennedy sent federal troops to integrate the University of Alabama. Why would she say that?
I think, for one thing, she had a crush on President Kennedy, and I think anything he did was okay. But I think because she admired President Kennedy so much, I think it helped her evolve in her thinking.
Is it fair, do you think, because when you read this, it is to contemporary ears, particularly to young people who did not live through this era. I remember this, and I had relatives just like yours.
Yeah.
So, and I remember being shocked as a young kid at some of the things that my grandmother would say about her maid, but when the maid wasn't there. And I thought, I've forgotten the maid's name now, but she was wonderful to me. And I thought, why would you be so mean? This is my grandmother, a woman that I loved. And I thought, this doesn't make any sense. And maybe that's where it came from in you as well. But is it fair to judge these people by today's standards?
No, I don't think it is. I think we're all victims of our past. I think we all carry baggage. And the fact of the matter is, I think people have evolved. I think people are still out there who have not. I mean, obviously, you pick up the newspaper and, you know, almost every day you hear some horrible comment that someone has made and they make a big deal about it in the news. So there are people who have not evolved. But I think, you know, I want to be an optimist. I think for the most part, people are seeing the world in a different way than people did back in 1964.
I mean, we're at a stage where I hope we're at a stage where the scab on that wound has begun to fall off, because it's pretty much what one hopes has healed, at least the most egregious parts of that. But then a book like this comes along, which reminds us of attitudes that were not, that are not terribly far removed from our time.
Yeah.
Do you worry that it opens the wound again?
Oh, no. I think we have to talk about our past. I think the worst thing that can happen is we brush everything under the rug, which I think a lot of people tend to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people like to remember those good old days back in the South when everybody was happy, everybody knew their place. And I think that's, we're not going to move forward if we have that kind of attitude.
And it is kind of, it was restrictive on black people, certainly, but there were people who probably would have liked to have had a relationship of some sort with certain African Americans, people who were white, and couldn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
So both sides were a little tied. The African Americans far more egregiously than the white people.
Yes, but, of course.
But nonetheless, there wasn't freedom of association.
No, there was not. And I think, you know, all those opportunities to interact and learn from each other, it saddens me that they weren't there.
When did it first dawn on you, if you remember, that the racial standards of the day that were perpetrated by Jim Crow and attitudes put forth by adults, white adults, in the face of African Americans demanding change, when did you realize that there's something fundamentally wrong here?
There's no particular moment when I said, gee, this is wrong. It was an evolution, and I think it's still an evolution. It happened over time, and, you know, I think I describe in my book, you know, I was very upset about George Wallace, and I think a lot of that was seeing the TV images of the fire hoses and the dogs and things that were going on in the Deep South, and I was horrified that my aunt and uncle were considering voting for him mm-hmm. in the 1968 election. But then again, you know, there's the election, and I go to prom the following spring, and the theme of the prom is Gone with the Wind. And I totally get caught up in the theme, and I dress up in my beautiful prom gown, and I thought I looked like Scarlett O'Hara. And
the Confederate flag is hanging there.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, it wasn't the sudden thing where I was enlightened. It was a process.
Yeah. You were a senior, I think, in high school when Alabama Governor George Wallace, or sophomore?
I was a senior during the 1968 election.
Okay, when he ran for president the first time, and you were the newly appointed Democratic chairman for the high school's mock election. I want to come back and talk a little bit about that, because that's not, I remember that election very clearly. We're coming right back. Helen Pruden Kaufman is our guest. Her book is called White Gloves and Collars. It's a memoir. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and North Carolina's Amtrak, offering travel to 16 North Carolina cities. Tickets, information, and details about summer kids travel at ncbytrain.org. The latest on Bo Bergdahl's release, new questions about the terms of the Taliban prisoner swap and implications for national security. All topics of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, including congressional oversight and efforts into closing Guantanamo. Show. That's coming up in just a few minutes. A reminder that our guest today, Helen Coffin, will be signing her book, White Gloves and Collards, at Park Road Books. That would be tonight at 7 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks will get you to us. And we're coming right back.
Saturday and Sunday mornings on WFAE, we bring you the week's news, but we might also take you along on an alligator hunt.
So right now we're in the flooded forest, and there's a bunch of cypress trees around with Spanish moss looking for the alligator snout, but right now it's just real flat.
News, conversations, and the unexpected. Weekend mornings from 8 to 10. It's Weekend Edition on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking this morning about a time not too far removed from where we sit today, but a time in which was very different from our own, thankfully. And it's because of our guest today, Helen Pruden Coffman, who has written a memoir about her growing up in Eatonton, North Carolina in the 1960s. And I guess 50s as well. The book is called White Gloves and Collards, a memoir. It's about growing up in a small town in the South and about how attitudes have changed as a result of the civil rights movement. But it's also a memoir, which has nothing to do with race in many cases. But you were a senior in high school in 1968 when Governor Wallace from Alabama was running for president. And at the time, the South was still staunchly Democratic, as was your Aunt Meg, I believe. And it shocked you as the president of or the chairman of the Democratic Party in the mock election in your high school. It shocked you that so many students were for George Wallace, that there were so many campaign posters that these students had created and hung on the school walls for George Wallace, that there was not a lot of space for you to put up Hubert Humphrey posters. Why were you shocked that there were so, given the times, that there were so many people your age in favor of George Wallace?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. The South was mainly Democratic. And although George Wallace, I guess, originally was a Democrat, he ran as the third party candidate, I was surprised that they just didn't, my fellow students just didn't automatically support Hubert Humphrey, who was the Democratic candidate. I think there were maybe one or two Nixon signs, but this was well before the Republican Party had the dominance that it now has in North Carolina. So it was basically Wallace versus Humphrey, and there weren't too many people I could sell on Humphrey.
And I think it was one of your relatives who said that they couldn't vote Republican because of the way Republicans had treated the South during Reconstruction. But I think it was the same woman who finally confessed to voting for Richard Nixon over Hubert Humphrey or George Wallace. Why would she choose Nixon over Wallace then?
Actually, it was my Aunt May.
Okay.
Who had talked about voting for Wallace,
mm-hmm.
and I think the reason was his platform of law and order. This was after the King assassination, where there was a lot of unrest throughout the country as a result of the assassination,
right.
And her feeling and my uncle's feeling was that Wallace will restore law and order to the country. And I think that was the main reason why she considered supporting him.
There were two paragraphs about that kind of took me by surprise, or maybe even took my breath away. You're having dinner with your aunt and uncle, and he says, well, at least Wallace is someone who will stand up for law and order. Under the Democrats, we sure wouldn't get much of that.
Yeah.
And you reply, but Humphrey would give the poor and the disenfranchised a voice, to which he said, that's exactly my point.
Right.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, you know, people didn't like protests. People were concerned about the Democratic Convention. I don't know if you remember. There was
a lot
of chaos.
Yeah. And rioting outside the Democratic Convention. What's his name? The news anchor. can't think of his name now for CBS. Dan Rather was carted off the convention floor by thugs, essentially.
Right.
The whole world is watching is what the people outside the convention hall were chanting as they threw rocks and bottles and things like that. It was a tumultuous time.
Yes, and for some reason, my aunt and uncle thought, well, George Wallace is the solution. You know, we'll have a very stable society if we have George Wallace in charge.
And your uncle followed up with this. The trouble with Humphrey and all those northern liberals is that they want the federal government to solve our country's race problems. Wallace believes that sort of thing should be left to the people. Who are the people?
I think he meant the white people. Yes, that was the attitude, and I think that's still an attitude that a lot of people have.
One of the things that struck me about those two passages were the fact that these are sentences that I hear today.
Yes.
In some people's mouths.
Yes.
Not necessarily and certainly not overtly about race, but about other issues and used to justify political positions. So I ask again, have we changed?
In some ways we have. And as you just pointed out, other ways, we have not.
Yeah. This is a memoir, and much of the book is about your family and has nothing to do with race. It's about growing up in a nice Mayberry by the Bay, essentially. It's about growing up in Edenton, which was very much like that, about trips to Nag's Head and trips to Asheville, about ordinary people having ordinary conversations in their ordinary lives. And sometimes they're unfavorably portrayed to 21st century eyes. Other times you look at them and think, that's like the way it was when I grew up, or I wish it were the way it was when I grew up. What has been the reaction of people you know in Edenton and family members in Edenton to this book? Because there's good, bad, and ugly here.
I have been pleasantly surprised. I thought I'd write my book and my family would like it. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure about the people in Edenton. I thought maybe I've been a little too honest in my portrayal of growing up there. And people have contacted me and told me how much the book meant to them, especially people my age say that it resonates with them. It was their experience, mm-hmm. and they'd never really known how to express it and describe it. I just got back from Edenton. I went there for a book reading at the Barker House, which is the visitor center, and I was amazed. I arrived in town. There were posters of me and my book all over town, and they actually sold tickets to hear me talk about my book. People paid $5, and they'd already sold 60 tickets when I stopped by the Barker House to check in before the event.
Wow.
So it was really quite heartwarming and amazing, the goodwill and the appreciation that a lot of people expressed for writing this book.
Now, your brother is mentioned in this book several times. He's your older brother, Norfleet, and he's actually here in the studio. Can I ask him to come over for a second? Would that be okay?
Yes, I would love that.
Come on over here for a second, Norfleet, because you lived through this. Pull up one of these other chairs. We have plenty of microphones to go around. They're free. There are no charge for these microphones. I had a conversation with my brothers not too long ago in which we were reminiscing about our parents and times when we were kids. And I brought something up. And I was absolutely thunderstruck to discover that my two brothers completely disagreed with my take on what had happened, that they each had their own individual remembrance of a particular event that did not in any way jibe with mine. So when you read through your sister's book here, do you remember these things as she has written them, or do you have a different take on some of these things?
You know, Mike, it was really uncanny when she let me read the first manuscript. Of course, I was scared to death how she would depict me. But I was blown away by memories that I had forgotten about long ago, how vividly they came back. And I think other than correcting a few name references or things like that, I had almost nothing to add from a factual depiction standpoint. Her memory is uncanny, and I was just blown away by how accurate it was and what strong memories it brought back for me.
And as these memories came back, if she had shared the manuscript to you before it became a book, could you have, would you have added other things that might have been pertinent that perhaps she didn't recall or were not as important to her because they didn't affect her as they may have affected you?
Yeah, we were a couple of years apart, 3 years apart in school, which, as you know, is an eternity when you're a young person.
Yeah, sure.
So I probably had some different experiences from her, but I thought the way she assimilated the story of our parents, in particular our mother and her values, mm-hmm. and tied it in with the civil rights movement, was just really hit the nail on the head for me. I mean, she mentions that our mother, the values that our mother held most dear were and insisted that we follow were be honest, be fair, and be kind. And I think part of the story of that time was that Jim Crow was neither honest nor fair nor kind. And
what is interesting about this book to me, and I'd like to hear from both of you about this, is that most books that have been written about that era focus in on people like Martin Luther King Jr. or other leaders and people on both sides of the issue, and race is the central theme, and race relations is the central theme. It is not necessarily the central theme in this book. It's family life, and percolating all around it is the racial strife and the racial issues of the day and Jim Crow, which makes it kind of insidious. You get a better understanding of what it was like to live through those times because it wasn't, at least for white people, top of mind. It was just out there on the periphery.
I think the one thing that makes Southerners different is that race is – the race, quote, issue is there for us all our lives. It molds who we are. It challenges our values, I think that's exactly right. I think it's still true today.
Hmm. Absolutely. I as I pointed out earlier, my initial intention was not to write about race. Right. I wanted to write the story about my childhood, and as I wrote, it was there. You know, I was in writing groups, and I'd write little vignettes about different topics, and race had a presence in just about every one of them. So it is a part of us, I think, as Southerners, and I still consider myself a Southerner, even though I live in California.
Mm-hmm. But even after Dr. King was assassinated, conversation would turn to that, and people would react to it, and then you write about, well, going back to cook the beef stew, because life goes on. And life does go on. I'm sure that happened even in some African American homes because they had to fix dinner for the kids and stuff. It just seemed almost mundane in some cases. Is that because it really didn't affect white people, race?
I think it's because people live their lives. If we look back, we'd like to say we were part of this great social movement, but people were living their lives. Blacks and whites. And I think it's only when we look back that, you know, we see it as this major movement, but people are tending to their daily business, their, you know, heartaches and, you know, joys. And
but both of you went to the University of North Carolina, right, after leaving Eatonton, and you stayed in North Carolina, Norfleet, and your sister went on to New England and eventually to Boston after college. And you say that you went to Boston because you wanted to separate yourself from the South, and you describe your early visits to North Carolina after that as representing two things, grief over your mother's death and shame for the racial system that you'd grown up with. Given that you're in Boston, which I've already pointed out is not exactly a racially integrated city at the time, why shame?
Because I think being a Southerner in a different part of the country, I had a Southern accent. I'd open my mouth. They'd know immediately that I wasn't from around there.
Yeah.
And people had stereotypes about Southerners. And the stereotype, unfortunately, was pretty negative, especially about white Southerners. There was an assumption that I was a racist, that my ancestors...
And they weren't?
That's correct.
Why?
Correct. because of the way Southerners have been portrayed, and I think because it was so close to the civil rights movement. It was 73 when I moved to Boston. And when I think about the Boston area, there is a difference between places like Southie and Charlestown that were affected by the federally mandated busing. But in the western suburbs of Boston, which was very liberal and still is, I think there was a disconnect to that, and people looked at the issue of civil rights from more of an intellectual point of view, mm-hmm. that, you know, it's wrong.
James on Facebook writes, could you ask Ms. Kaufman if she believes that the current climate of anger displayed by many Tea Party and Republican representatives stems in part from a reaction to desegregation and the civil rights legislation of that era, in particular school desegregation?
I wish I knew. I'm still trying to figure out the Tea Party.
When they say they want to take the country back, is that what they're talking about?
In some ways, I think it could be, and I think that's very frightening. I think if it means we want to have a fair society where there's input from everyone about things that we spend our tax dollars on and that sort of thing, I think that's positive.
But your mother tried, and you write many times in this book, she tried from time to time to explain white attitudes toward blacks to you, and you've since had to explain to your children the South of your growing up, and probably when they were growing up, white attitudes toward blacks as well, because we were still evolving. Did you hear echoes of your mother in those explanations to your children?
Oh, yes. And I think a lot of people, you know, realize as they get older, they're turning into their mothers or for males turning into their fathers. Yeah. Yes. And I, you know, sometimes I hear myself even use expressions that my mother would use.
When you've been away for a while, first in Boston, now in San Diego, when you come home, do you see a landscape that has predominantly changed, or are there things lurking in the shadows? 15 seconds.
Oh, things have changed a lot. But then again, things haven't. For example, in Edenton, there used to be a billboard as you entered the city saying, or the town saying, "Welcome to progressive and historical Edenton." Now it just says, "Welcome to historical Edenton."
Ooh. White Gloves and Collards is the name of Helen Pruden Kaufman's memoir, which is an interesting story just if you take the race out of it. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.